We've spent so much time nationally, but you know what? Locally, Illinois is going crazy. At least the Democrats in Illinois are going crazy. Governor Pritzker, who wants to sit on one of those White House toilets of his, bring gold ones to the White House. He wants to be elected president. And Mayor Johnson failing and flailing as the aldermen, all 50 of them vote him down. Amazing. Just amazing. And then you've got Trump and the men without chests and the fight over the cabinet appointments and all the pearl clutching going on in Washington as he puts street fighters around him, and he needs street fighters. And joining us today to talk about all this is Tom Serafin, my friend and owner of Serafin and Associates, and also host of the Crisis Cast podcast. And with us, as always, Jeff Carlin of WGN Radio, executive producer there, future physics teacher, husband to Christine, and Steve the pilot noted that I'm sitting on a chair that's not squeaky, and that's because Christine gave me a recommendation on a good ergonomic chair. And me, I'm John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. And where are you as Trump is in a street fight, as Brandon Johnson has another panic attack, as Governor Pritzker, the fat boy, is like, come on, you've got to come through me, like a real tough guy, a real tough guy. Amazing. You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
So as promised, I know you hate me saying as promised, but it is a promise.
I love it, John.
Tom Serafin is our guest. Tom is the principal owner of Serafin and Associates, and he's also the head honcho and the host of the Crisis Cast podcast, which I listen to, and he's also my friend, my very good friend. And there wouldn't be a John Cass News without him, because when at my darkest moments, when I was afraid of, I was losing it, he came through and lashed a stick to my backbone and said, get on there and cowboy up and get to work. And I appreciate it, Tom. I know I embarrass you by saying that, but it's true.
John, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners, whenever they're listening. And that was a very kind opening. You know, friends are friends for life. So, it doesn't matter who we are, where we are. We kind of look out in love for each other. And as we approach Thanksgiving, with you and Jeff and the family and Betty and everyone, I'm lucky to be here myself, thanks to Ann, and who's pulled me through a lot of dark nights, dark days. So I'm sure our listeners, experience everything in life that we have experienced, and probably more. So it's great to be here to talk and have some fun with you guys.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. So good to have you here. And a preemptive happy Thanksgiving. I know some people are happier than others this time around. It's Tom, I'm glad to have you, because I want to ask you. I mean, you're a guy who's been in the business. You're a political strategist and have had your hand at the helm of campaigns in the past. People are you're hypothesizing all this stuff about Trump's picks, right, for appointments for various cabinet members, and they're freaking out. And I see it as a chess move, as this is Trump's trying to put stuff out there to be like, hey, this is important, and if you like it, you don't like it, but if you're not going to support me, I know I'm going to hear it, and I'm gonna remember that when things really start to move. And it feels like it's a litmus test for those around him, because you know that the left is gonna blow their top no matter what he says. But I feel like it's really targeted at those who are supposedly say that are loyal, but he's like, what, I'm going to put this out there, you support me or not, like that kind of thing. What do you think?
Well, elections have consequences, and we know that here at home in Chicago, in the mayoral race. And then we also saw just recently in the race to elect an elected school board. So, you know, we're all going to be subject to the individuals that were elected, and you may disagree with them. Some may disagree with them all the time, others part-time, or agree with them. I mean, elections have consequences. Donald Trump won. 76 million people voted for him. 73 million people voted for Vice President Harris. He won many states. He did better than most people ever thought he would. He won what they call the Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina.
Blue wall.
Yeah. The blue wall.
Took down the wall, yeah.
Yeah, Arizona. And I mean, in cities like New York and Chicago and the state of Illinois, he actually increased the outcome on the Republican side.
Picked up four points in Illinois. Is that right? Is that what it was?
Something close to that. You're right, Jeff. And what's interesting about his vote is that he shifted the Republican Party in this process. For the first time, low-income voters, low-educated voters, people that usually vote and who usually win in elections, cast such a large vote for Donald Trump that he carried him into the White House. It wasn't the wealthy. It wasn't the elites. The cities, the states, along the Atlantic, Pacific Ocean, when you look at California and Oregon and Washington, it's usually the states on the coast that go for the Democrats. It was the same thing up in the Northeast as well as on the West Coast. So it was what they call flyover states, except for Illinois. And I think it was New Mexico, in Colorado, the states, all went for Donald Trump. And so it's his cabinet. And he's getting to it. He understands it's just a four-year term. Usually when people have only 4 years left on their terms, they have a good 18 months, maybe almost 2 years before they begin to lose their ability to make things happen. So he's got to move quickly. He went through it last time, then paralysis sent in, impeachment sent in. So this is a president that knows, this is a president-elect that knows what it's like to be a president buried in quicksand before he gets into the White House and is sworn in as president. So he's moving very fast, and he's going to challenge everyone. And if somebody's up there in Capitol Hill to challenge him, he's prepared. And knowing how Washington is and knowing the people in Washington today, I don't see a lot of challengers.
All right.
Well, remember that, as you said, Tommy, he was beset by the swamp, but the swamp creatures actively came out to sabotage him. The FBI was run by James Comey. He was spying on people, spying on Trump's people. Hillary Clinton dropped that Steele dossier with a fake Russia collusion story, and John Brennan of the CIA and Comey of the FBI ran with it. And Trump has apparently decided, and I support him in this, to bring forth in his cabinet a bunch of street fighters, because he's in a street fight. And I see Matt Gaetz, who's not my cup of tea party, but that's Trump's choice, to fight off the obvious and clear leverage or whatever from the Justice Department. You got to get those people back in line, or we won't have a country. And Tulsi Gabbard, who was attacked and beset upon by intelligence people calling her a Russia collusion or Russia agent, like Hillary Clinton was saying,
she was on the TSA watch list, and she and her family would be pulled over at TSA checkpoints. And you know, subject to intensive, you know, investigation before they kept, before she can move on, which is extraordinary.
So she's a street fighter. They got other people. Kennedy, I don't think people really think that the federal government should be beholden to big pharma. I really don't think that, or the big agriculture that manufactures food that people get fat and obese on and get diabetes. And so he's fighting with these people. And I think that's why he was elected. And if you don't, if you oppose him, as Jeff said, you stand the chance of being primaried, don't you?
Well, I would think so, the way they're starting to put together their operation. I mean, they're still running they have their own campaign operation that they ran, and they're going to continue to do that. You're right. You know, the president always has, or usually suffers statistically, a downturn in representation being elected, you know, maybe your favorite part of being elected in the 2-year term, the off year elections. And the House is so close. I think it's 5 votes right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a very competitive situation. But for the first time in many, many, many years, the numbers, even despite redistricting and the geographic trends for the GOP have not been favorable over the years. Democrats got 68 million votes and 73 million votes for the Republican Party. And those votes represent people that voted for congressional representation in the House of Representatives. So for the first time, that generic vote, you know, do you favor a Republican or a Democrat? It favored a Republican for the first time in scores of years.
That's huge.
So they have to produce in these 2 years. I think Jeff mentioned it. You have to produce in these 2 years. Otherwise, there will be another shift 2 years from today. And I think that's why they're moving so quickly. They know they have to move quickly. They don't have a lot of time. A lot get done in a very, very, very short time.
Well, I think it's a street fight. Do you guys? That's what this is.
I mean, maybe, John, but, you know, this is second time around, right? I mean, you kind of alluded to it, Tom. He already went through, you guys are talking about it, right? He already went through this. He got bogged down the first time by all sorts of, you know, mishigash, and then he comes out this time and he's, you know, he's firing on all cylinders, and he's got the majority. He's got the rubber stamp. I mean, he's got the mandate. The last time around, it was razor thin. He didn't have the popular vote. It was, you know, he barely had control of the House or in the Senate. So it's like, okay, well, he was doing what he was doing in his first time in, new to politics, new to D.C. kind of thing. And he, you know, he did what he did. He kept his own, and he, you know, he drained the swamp as best he could, in his words. But I think this time around, John, I think he's got the momentum. I think he's got them on the ropes. I think, you know, we talked about this, your brother, the powers that be, that are, if you want to call it the deep state, they're going to recoil and go back into the shadows and wait until their opportunity again. They're going to ride this thing out, because I don't think it's going to be a street fight. I think it's going to be an onslaught. I mean, I think he's going to have all the cards to play. He's going to know
what he wants to do. That's why he needs Gates. I'm sorry, but that's why he thinks he needs Gates.
Well, he needs people who are loyal to him, and Gates has proven time and time again. I mean, he's a flawed candidate, he's only going to make it through a recess appointment, and still going to put him up there for 2 years because they won't be able to take him down. So he's going to be there no matter what, and he's loyal, and he's going to do whatever Trump says, and Trump's lawyers are going to help him tell him what to say, and, you know, because he's got a phalanx of lawyers, and it's going to be Trump's world. I don't think it's going to be a street. They're going to be roving the halls of quote-unquote government and making it the way they want when they leave.
Well, one thing they might do, and I've heard this from Victor Davis Hanson and others, is that, I mean, I think that they should take the FBI and move it out of Washington. You can't move the CIA out of Virginia because, well, you have the federal government there, but why not move the FBI out? Why not move these big agencies out?
I've been vocal about that for the last few years, especially about the Department of Agriculture It should be located in the heartland. One of the problems that the people in Washington have is that they like to go to work. When they do, I mean, less than 7% are showing up in their offices today, in federal employees, because since COVID, they haven't been, you know, forced to do it. There's a couple of ways of taking a look at how you move those large bureaucracies. If you move ag to Kansas City, you probably lose 20%, maybe a little bit more, of the employees that don't want to move there. So that's a way to cut costs and move that industry closer to central portions of the country where the farm belt is, where farmers can actually reach out and exchange. Now, the downside to that, if you're a Republican, is that if you move it, those large bureaucracies with those large numbers of employees to a red state, you're in danger of making it into a blue state. So politically, they're also thinking with both hats. Yeah. I mean, the FBI is supposed to be building this huge building in D.C. And one of the ideas was, I read an article about the possibility of the FBI moving to Milwaukee. Well, what a great, you know, economic influx that would be for the city of Milwaukee that desperately needs it in the metropolitan area. It's not a bad idea to move the branches of government closer to the people, but to get out of D.C., that's going to be very difficult. Remember, you know, despite what the numbers were for Trump around the country in Washington, D.C., he lost Washington, D.C., you know, it was 92% for Vice President Harris. So that is a blue city, but I understand why they want to do that. I think that's an idea worth investigation. You know, I mean, Elon Musk and Vivek are two of the individuals that the president has put in charge to, it's not a government office, but it's an office to look at, you know,
exploratory committee.
Yeah. Waste and everything else. Elon Musk said somewhere in a speech last week or the week before that, you know, asking people to come back to work would probably save, you know, another 20%. People, you know, are so accustomed to working at home now, more than 95% are still at home, federal employees. That's a lot. You know, it's a big number.
What they might want to break up, I think this is what the American people don't like. They don't like, for example, a media guy like me and my wife, say, was a senior regulator in some federal bureaucracy, or like Andrea Mitchell and on MSNBC and her husband who ran the Federal Reserve. They don't like that. They don't like that that spousal combine thing. I don't think so. I think they get nervous and they don't like the look of it.
You know, if you live in D.C., it's impossible if you're a young person or you're single and you're going out and dating. It's almost impossible to date somebody that's not, you know, involved.
Right.
I think it's a huge millions of people that work for the federal government. I know Dana Bash at CNN, you know, is married to John King, you know, who's a terrific young reporter, in their divorce, and she married a CIA contractor, who incidentally was one of those guys that signed that letter, one of the 51 individuals signed that letter, you know, years ago. So everybody is kind of, it's incestuous. It is Washington. You know, it's what
but
it
it's,
is.
You know what? I mean, in a Trump's, you know, worldview there, that this, and it's gotten too incestuous. Like we've let it happen. It's festered. You know, the halls of government are padded with dollar bills and promises and all this crap that has just been happening and growing and growing. Why not? I say move the FBI to Detroit. Talk about a city that could use something.
Oh, yeah.
Make it a tech hub and a security hub. I mean, you've got the border. And right there. I mean,
build a building and name it after Elmore Leonard.
Okay. But I like that idea. I mean, break because, you know, technology, technology has given us the benefit, and, you know, and Musk is going to be the guy who's going to probably push this piece of it, because that's his thing. the technologies allows us to move things. We know before it was convenient, you know, a subpoena needs to go across the hall. We need to get records from this and that or whatever, research, yada, yada, yada. But now it's all digital. Now we can get online. Now they can do this work anywhere. So yeah, they've proven that. So let's break it up. Let's break up the bank. You know, the big baby bell or big bell's got to go.
So the people that felt on the fringes of the economy who had a real sense of, you know, not being secure, they called the security gap, you know, voted for Donald Trump. And it goes back to what you're talking about, Jeff. Black men, you know, the shift was 25%.
Amazing.
Non-white 18 to 44 was a 21% shift. Non-white, non-college men, 21% shift over to Donald Trump. Latino men, 19%. Non-white urban, 16%. I mean, you go through the numbers, high school or less, 14%. Non-white small towns, rural. I mean, he won most of the small rural towns in the country. And here's the interesting statistic. Should he become a nice guy now, or should he continue to do what he's trying to do? He's only got 4 years, really 18 months to 20 months, somewhere in that period of time. So he's got to move quickly. 41% of those people that were undecided, independent, persuadable type voters down the stretch, 41% said they didn't like him, but we sure like his ideas about the economy and immigration. We love that part of it, but you know, we don't like the guy. But a lot of them voted for him. Yeah, a lot of them voted for him, despite the fact. So he's not going to run again, and you don't have to worry about that part. So right now, his attitude is, I'm going to do everything I can right now to get this job done, and especially when it comes to his cabinet, he's going to say, "You want to fight? I'll fight you." Israel Ambassador Mike Huckabee, there's a guy who can play his guitar. He's going to sit there.
That's right.
You know, and he's, you know, so UN Ambassador Elise Stefanik, I think she is going to be, you know, very good. The border czar this time. Tom Holman is accepting that title, the border czar. That's going to be, I think he's going to be first day, going to be the surprise in the first 3 months.
He's going to be like the hard sheriff in a Larry McMurtry novel, you know?
Right. CIA agency, John Ratcliffe. You know, I'm interested because he's got a very good reputation in D.C. from on both sides of the aisle, not because they love him, but they know he's a professional. And when he says he's going to go in there and open up what happened to John Kennedy and other documents, you know, he means it. He's not one of those blowhards. He doesn't say a lot. He just acts. And the history of his performance, you know, in this business is evidence of that. Mike Waltz, I think, is a good national security advisor. You know, I think Marco Rubio is going to do a good job as Secretary of State.
What about Hegseth?
Hegseth, you know, he's got a very colorful background that, you know, some people would disapprove of, other people would approve of. But I think his ability, you know, he wrote the book, a couple of them. He wrote one about the what's wrong with the Defense Department and what's going on with the combat veteran, Princeton. I think it was at Harvard and Princeton. Yeah. Right? He's smart and he's tough. And I think he's going to do a good job. Obviously, the undersecretaries at the Defense Department are so important because they actually make things happen down deep into them. Right. That's a huge, you know, $900 billion organization with millions of people.
He's got to set a tone. And one tone that I hope he sets is that the military is not about nation building like under Bush. The military is about killing people and breaking stuff. That's what they do. So, like, get to it again. All this DEI nonsense.
After he gets through his nomination hearings, I'd see him probably in the first couple weeks terminating some of the generals responsible for the Afghanistan, you know, the debacle. He will make a stand on that. You know, if you got a star on your shoulder, you know, you're going to have to be answering to your abilities. The Navy is so crippled right now. They need real direction. They have the resources, but the bureaucracy is so heavy. so heavy in a system today where some good software could really make things happen much faster and quicker.
Yeah, that's the efficiency I'm hoping comes to. And that's the type of stuff that, in theory, would trickle down to the average Joe, is that if the economy, if our government can be better at its job in any sort of way, any marginally, it'll be better for all of us. But, you know, I'm expecting them to come in and, you know, turn the tap off in Ukraine and apply it to wherever they think that it's going to need to be. And, you know, whatever that's going to be, is it going to be at the border? Is it going to be, you know, building up the Navy, something like that? It'll be interesting to see how quickly this machine starts to, you know, slow down.
To answer your question, can Marco Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio from Florida, and Israel Ambassador Mike Huckabee, can they be the kind of diplomats that we, you know, remember when we were growing up, where people would go in and deal in troubled areas and bring a ceasefire to everyone? And they're going to be carrying the messages of Donald Trump, who will use the hammer when necessary. Yeah. Those two gentlemen are going to have the work cut out for them immediately. Homeland Security with Kristi Noem, that one I don't understand.
I don't like that. I don't
understand that.
She killed her dogs, goddamn. I mean, I don't want you dog killer, get out of here. I don't want her around.
But, you know, Homeland Security would require somebody that could open that department up. Remember that there was no department like that, right, you know, before 9/11. And all of a sudden, that's a huge bureaucracy.
Powerful. I mean, think about it. What they control, or the ports, I mean, all that stuff. It's crazy.
They're going to find out how the border was opened, really. They're going to find stuff out about Mayorkas. All that stuff's going to come out. That's another thing. That's why they don't like the Washington, official Washington, does not like these cabinet appointments, because they want to protect their own nests. And those days are over. They're going to be found out, dragged out of their homes. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to shoot Liz Cheney, but I wouldn't mind giving her a mootzah, you know, without hurting her physically.
Well, my hope is that they kind of look forward with lessons of the past, right, as a way to help guide them. You know, the FISA court's this situation where the judges barely, you know, look at the information and they agree all the time. And the investigations of Americans, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, you know, a director of national intelligence today, she was on the watch list. She's a soldier, former congresswoman. Right. So what's interesting about, you know, if I was writing a book about this cabinet situation, I think a lot of people want to, I would call it The Hunted Are Now the Hunters.
It's an old Patti Page song. I think I would call it Trump versus the Men Without Chests, because that's what I'm writing. That's the headline of the one I'm writing now. We make men without chests and expect from them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. CSOs, Men Without Chests.
When was that written?
That was written in his 1943 book called The Abolition of Man. And in it, he devoted time. You know, C.S. Lewis created the world of Narnia. You know, that's where Obama lives as a forest fawn, as a gentle forest fawn smoking opium, where the children come to have teas and cakes with him. But he also wrote Abolition of Man, examining how human beings are reduced to either the intellect or base impulses, and they take their own souls out of their body. They remove them. They dig down deep and remove them, and that's why he calls them these soulless. He calls them men without chests. And again, the quote is, we make men without chests and expect from them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst.
He wrote that in 43 during the war.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it applies very well today.
To the what people call the Combine or the Uniparty, yeah. Where they defer. Everyone defers to authority and they clutch their pearls and they, what are people going to say about the, you know, the Trump cabinet? Oh my God. And they just, they, you know, you guys are more realistic. He won the election and he won with a mandate. Let's see what happens.
Well, having spent a few years in D.C. on the Hill working for the U.S. Senator from Illinois, the great Alan Dixon, I learned a lot in moving around. And it's a collegial institution where everybody relies on each other, kind of say, okay, don't worry about it. I can take care of it. I can do this, you know, blah, blah, blah. But these members of the cabinet, half a dozen of them, every one of them will have their lives turned inside and out during this confirmation hearing. The best investigators that the FBI, CIA have are already doing that work now for the opposition party. And they're also, I don't know if they're being vetted by the White House. I don't think the White House wants the FBI to vet them. I think they've got other people to do that work for. Right. But you have to admire the fact that they're all willing to go through that process. And they're willing to, you know, fall on the sword on this one. I'm impressed that somebody is actually willing to do it. So these people, you know, you talk about Matt Gaetz, he's been through the ringer. And, you know, if you take a hard look at his career, he's a very bright young man. But his personality is, you know, lacking. And he's not a gentleman many times. However, he's there, and he's going to go toe to toe with these guys, and that's a battle I'm looking for. Pete Hegseth, the defense guy, I'm looking at that battle, yeah. And Tulsi Gabbard, you know, who's so well spoken and soft spoken, and she uses deadly language, and she says it in a way that's not laconic, but it's so kind of quietly said, and you say to yourself, did I just hear that?
Well, she eviscerated Kamala Harris during the Democratic primary. Remember that debate? She called her out, and she did it politely, but well, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see the Democrats and some of the Republicans, you know, go after the cabinet officials in the confirmation hearings. It's going to be great theater, you know, live television.
One thing I do have to ask you about, Tom, is not Washington, but what the heck is going on in Chicago and Illinois? We've got Pritzker yelling, you know, you've got to come through me, like he's a tough guy, a real tough guy. I said at your event that you had this week, that the Chamber of Commerce event, that he was measuring, he looked to me like a guy measuring the White House toilets, you know? And I don't know what he's trying to accomplish, but, and then what about Mayor Johnson? Amazing. 50 aldermen voted against him on a major piece of policy.
I know the Wall Street Journal editorial said he was the worst mayor in the country. But you know, that's terrible for Chicago. If you're in business and you want to do business in the city and you want to employ people, and you know, I've met the mayor several times. He's a real gentleman. He's a nice person to talk to, but he's getting advice from folks that I don't think have his best welfare at heart. And, you know, you have to surround yourself with a good staff when you're in an elected office. And sometimes people, you know, take the same people that they were on the campaigns with into the kind of government offices. And it's two lines of work. It's like hiring a welder to do electrician's work. It doesn't, you know, Brian Boyer, who was great Sun Times reporter and was the first one to discover those bullets were all went inside in the Fred Hampton situation. They weren't being shot from the inside out. It was outside in by the police. And ended up with Harold Washington as his press secretary. He told me a long time ago, that, you know, politics was like having sex and government was having the baby. You know, it's two different ways of living.
That's a Democrat for you. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so, you know, he needs great staff in a very difficult time with the deficit that we have, $1 billion in city government, $1 billion in schools, and he runs everything. I mean, he's in control of both right now. Well, the state can't help out. They're $3.2 billion in debt. And you have a new president, Donald Trump, that wants to help and show people around the world that he's not the worst person in the world, that he wants to help everybody. He keeps saying we need to grow America before we send our money overseas. So there should be a largesse there available in D.C. for municipalities and others. And Chicago is one of them. So I would, you know, Richard Daley said this a long time ago when he was one of the few people that would talk to Richard Nixon, the president, and meet him at the airport when others would not, that he's my president for the entire country. But when it comes for elections, I'll do everything I can to defeat him. But now the election is over with. He's the president of the United States, and I will support him.
That comes right from the Daily history. In New Orleans, it was New Orleans at a Democratic National Convention or meeting, and he stood up and the chairman said, "We will always recognize the delegate from Chicago." And he stood up and said the exact thing. Nixon, the president is not my cup of tea. I will work against him during the election. But for right now, he's the president of the United States. He's my president. I always respected him.
But the Democrats in Illinois don't play like that. They don't think. I mean, Pritzker's way out ahead of everything, telling people, "I'm not going to work with. He's going to have no help here from us. Forget it. No way. He's going to do whatever he wants, and we're going to fight him. Make this state the haven for the whole country." I mean, that's the stuff he's going to run up against.
Do you think now I'm plumbing you for another column? Do you think that's wise, Tom and Jeff?
If my tone didn't portray my true feelings, I apologize.
I got it. I'm just being rhetorical.
Yeah, I got it. In a situation like that, having been on the other side of an election victory more often than not, which, you know, you remember those, you remember the losses more than you remember the victories.
Yeah.
And you always advise whether you win or lose, your candidate to let the dust settle before you start claiming one side versus another side or suggesting that you understand what the numbers are the day after the election versus what the numbers are not. His numbers people probably are taking a hard look at Illinois' turnout and Chicago's turnout and looking at the country's turnout. And yes, he's obviously got ambitions to become president of the United States, and that's great. You know, the nuns used to tell us all in school, you know, you can be president of the United States if you work hard. So those ambitions are good and healthy, but you also have to take care of the situation in front of you. And, you know, Gavin Newsom right now is out there hustling as well, you know, with the failed state of California as his work product, which is kind of, you know, odd. So, you know, Pritzker is going to be in the race, whether, you know, you agree with him or not. He's going to be in the top five, top seven. So if he does enough for the state of Illinois currently, you know, it's just going to brighten up his future. And he should do it with all the federal money he can convince the feds, you know, to work with. And we have an Illinois delegation, as you well know, that's dominated, you know, on the Democratic side, you know, 17 representatives, and I think 14 are Democrats, 3 are Republicans. So, you know, they're in the minority in the House of Representatives in the appropriation process.
But there is a Illinois person who's remarkably tuned in to Washington right now, and that's an old friend of yours, former Congressman Sherry Bustos. No.
Right, right. She is a 10-year congressman, and now she runs a firm called Mercury, Illinois. And she and her colleagues are well respected, you know, on both sides of the aisle. It's a nonpartisan firm, and actually one of her partners is on a leave of absence, and she is now running the White House, Susan Willis. And so she's very close to those individuals there, and she's got friends on the transition committee. So she is in a position to be, you know, very helpful for Illinois, and she's a Democrat. And, you know, when she ran five times for Congress and won her district three times in the last three elections, all went for Donald Trump, but she was elected. So, you know, she understands what it's like to be in a district where you have to be able to appeal to everyone. You can't be party line straight down. You have to understand the rural voters, which is important, which the Democrats seem to have lost connections with, as well as her cities were Rockford, the Rock Island area, Moline, and then Peoria. So she understands, and all those towns have desperate economic needs and really need to be rebuilt and regenerated. So it's a good point you bring up, John. She can be a real, you know, conduit for, you know, the governor and the mayor in D.C. You know, the congressional delegation, unfortunately, you know, does a lot of, you know, good work, you know, with individuals. But they, I think they're going to need a lot more than that, because the partisanship in the first year or two here, if they are partisan, unfortunately, it's not going to be helpful to Illinois. And take the long view, John. The long view is he's only going to be there for 4 years. And if you know anything about politics, after 2 years, you know, the opposition will have their way with him. So that's the reason he's trying to get an early start, trying to dig in with some ferocious, tough cabinet officials that are focused. Remember, you know, it's easy to be focused coming out of college, but if you've been the hunted and now you're the hunter, you have a much more deeper personal focus.
Exactly. 100%.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you guys, you know, because I saw a statistic that came out of the Media Research Center, because one of the things that has surprised me about this election cycle was the lack of impact the legacy media had. Oh. I grew up watching ABC, CBS, and NBC evening news coverage. And if you take a look at their votes, you know, I say not their votes, but the way they covered the campaign in 2024, 78% of the stories about Vice President Harris were positive. Only 15% of Donald Trump were positive. That's a Democratic advantage of 63%. Yet it did not work. It did not work in this particular cycle. I think the legacy media is, you know, nice to have out there on television if you don't have any other programming, but its impact as far as a believable institution or where their news is believable is really on the way out. And in that, you know, we had a Chamber of Commerce event the other morning where we had Shia Kapos of Illinois Political, Mike Flannery, the great political expert, and John Cass of johncassnews.com.
Hey, I know him.
Yeah. And we all kind of agreed that new media and the two most powerful websites about politics in Illinois today are those two websites. We had, and that's where people are going today, johncassnews.com and Shia Kapos at the Illinois Political. I mean, what did the people do with their news intake anymore? Why have they turned away from the legacy media?
Because, well, in the old days, I mean, yeah, you could see it happening. In the old days, there were people like Eric Zorn and Mary Schmeek playing their 12-string guitars, singing their folk songs. Nobody wants to sing old-timey folk songs anymore. The legacy media has shot its foot off, and it's infected. Nobody listens to them, Tom. And Jeff, you know this, when you try to book guests, you're not thinking who from the legacy media. I mean, you look for somebody like Phil Wegman from Real Clear Politics, or Leland Vittert, maybe, if you want somebody from a network type show. But you don't go to Chicago Tribune or Chicago Sun-Times? Come on.
No. I mean, the cable media still has as a power hold. I mean, on the core of a lot of people who I think probably are even more swing than actual dyed-in-the-wool Democrats. But it's an interesting thing why it changed this time around. But I think people are getting media at different places right now. We're getting more on social, more and more on the internet, on other sites, Real Clear Politics too. I mean, isn't that mix of Illinois type media? I just don't think people there was enough there for Kamala for them to shine up and show off to the world, and that it fell so flat that you could see how hard they were trying to make those stories positive, but they just really couldn't. And my litmus test has always been, like my dad, who's very, very progressive, very, very liberal, and some of my friends who I grew up with, the same thing. They, all of them, were saying how disappointed in her as being the candidate, and how disappointed they were in Biden for letting it linger that long and not letting some other fruit bear. And I think it was the candidate herself. I mean, she dropped out, so early in the primaries. She was not a good candidate and every time she's run. And I think that's what it was really ultimately comes down to. They didn't have anybody. There was no one there.
Listen, it comes down to you're at the grocery store. You're getting groceries for your family. And you have to put stuff back.
Right.
I grew up in a grocery store. I grew up in business. I know
right.
that face.
Right.
People have to put it back. There's no more crab meat for you, honey. You know?
Right. Well, and Kamala and her ilk have spent a lot of time ignoring that fact and exactly. just focusing on the angry orange man that's scaring them.
And the media.
And that's what it was.
Yeah. The media trying to tell you that the economy is great when you're putting back the bacon because you can't afford it.
Right. Your 401k is good, but you can't feed your kids. Right.
Yeah.
What there's a statistic that's kind of correlates to that because younger people don't they don't watch television newscasts.
Right.
Which is interesting. They get their information through their telephone and through a variety of internet sites. But if you were 18 to 29 in this election, Clinton had a 19% advantage in 2016, Biden a 24% advantage in 20. This year, Harris had an 11% advantage, meaning Donald Trump come into that category, deeply. And this, if you were 30 to 44, Clinton had a plus 10, Biden a plus 6, Harris a plus 1. And then here's the interesting shift. 45 to 64 years old, Trump in 16 had a plus 8, Trump had a plus 1, and in 24 he had a plus 10, really kind of stayed the same as 16. But if you were 65 or older, my crowd, Trump had a plus 7 in 16, plus 5 in 20, and a tie in 24. So he lost ground with people my age or older, and he gained ground on the individuals that are 44 and younger. That's bad news for the Democrats, bad news for the legacy media. Despite being overwhelmingly involved, pushing the Harris candidacy, the young people don't watch, and the older people don't listen anymore. And so it's very interesting to me. They didn't like Donald Trump's personality. They had to hold their nose. And the younger folks behind him, they're looking for some momentum and some change. Can he deliver in 2 years? If he doesn't, I think you both mentioned 10 minutes ago that the vote will swing back to the Democrat side. And the Democrats have to figure out how they're going to go at this thing. And they got to get it done now.
He's got to deliver now. That's what that's why he's got these people.
Right. And the Democrats have to deliver now. They have to stop him along the way somewhere where it doesn't appear as though they're just making stops, for political gains. They have to have a program as well.
Yeah, but they don't, unfortunately. All they have is, like, I saw the combine mouthpiece on Fox News, Neil Cavuto, interviewing James Clyburn just before you came on. Clyburn is still pushing the Trump is Hitler, Trump is Hitler, and Cavuto is mealy mouth, as always, like a Chris Wallace clone. And he doesn't have the testicular fortitude to push back. And that's
they should take the lessons from. They should take the lesson from Governor Shapiro and a few other Democrats that are, yes, that are moving towards the middle, or somebody who's been in the middle like he has been. They need to learn from this. Voters rejected across the board, not by huge margins, but significant margins that they need to learn from and take lessons from. History will teach them that. The more they and the quicker they move towards that center and reach halfway, the better it will be for them. They could probably regain the House of Representatives in 2 years if they learn that lesson.
Well, right now, they're not learning it, and we're going to have to leave it at that. Tom Serafin, thanks, buddy. Thanks for being here on the Chicago Way.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Thank you, and don't forget, guys, it's johncastnews.com.
You're the creator of that. Thank you, my friend.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Anyway, I'm proud. Cool. I'm happy for your success, and God bless you both. And, you know, John, you've had 2 years of a tough way, you know, health wise. But you looked great the other day. You were moving around great, and so, you know, God bless you. I know you're working hard at it.
Well, I'm trying. Thanks, well, Tom.
Listen to Betty.
All right, I always listen to her and you. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Same to you.
For Tom Serafin, our friend of Serafin Associates and host of the Crisis Cast podcast, one of my favorites, a good man, a decent man. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, the best thing he did was marry Christine. Thanks, Christine, for letting him come on this podcast. And for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Subscribe today because we need you. Join us. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you again next time on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.